Podcast, July 2026 edition, with Joshua Bishop, Jesse Murray, Louis Hury, Jamie Inslee, Sahini Dutta, and Barbara Cabrales. Welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Josh, and joining me today in the studio is Jesse.
Hi all!
In this month's episode, we talk to Dr. Seshradi Nadafer from the Institute of Cosmology and Gravitation at the University of Portsmouth about his work in cosmology. Then, from the University of Nottingham, we talk to Dr. Maggie Liu about her endeavours to use machine learning in her work on galaxy clusters. Finally, for this month's soundbite, myself and Louis interview the attendance of the Euclid UK and LSST UK meetings 2026. But first, Jesse, the news.
Magnetic push and pull. Scientists have combined multi-scale observation to shine a light on how magnetic fields can guide the way that stars form. The team pointed three different instruments at the G33.92+0.11 cloud located 7 kiloparsecs away, roughly 23,000 light years from Earth. G33 is a particularly interesting region because it's a complex which is pretty thin and that we view face on. So we have a clear top-down view of what's happening here. The system consists of giant filaments, several parsecs long, tens of light years, that are converging towards a massive central hub, forming what we typically call a hub filament system. In that hub, we've observed spiral-like arms feeding two massive star-forming regions, where we spotted 28 baby stars distributed along both the spiral-like structures and the central cores. What makes this study special is that it's essentially the first time that we've been able to follow the same magnetic fields from the cloud scale down to the individual streamers. The combined observations from the polarimeter on the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, the ACA, and ALMA, to see how the structure of the magnetic fields change from approximately 5 parsecs down to a scale of 4,000 astronomical units. That's a change of scale of over 250 times smaller. The magnetic field lines appear to be bent in broad U-shapes, as though the flowing gas has grabbed hold of them and dragged them inwards. The moving large-scale gas strengthened and bent the fields to the point where they are strong enough to regulate the flow of gas at the smaller scales, and forcing it to stay compact, leading to stars forming within the streamers I mentioned earlier. The team also proposes a new way of estimating magnetic field strengths. By measuring how sharply the field lines curve, they can estimate the magnetic tension force and infer how the field strength changes across different scales. Now, I understand that this can all sound a little abstract to you, so if you want to learn more about how interstellar magnetic fields affect the way that stars form and how we observe and measure them, give a listen to the March 2024 episode, where Dr. Kate Paddle explains it all in great detail.
It's not often we hear about magnetic fields in astronomy. Quite famously, we often ignore them and all the problems we have. So, can you sort of talk us through how impressive is it they've managed to measure these magnetic fields along these massive filaments of large-scale structure?
So, without getting too much into the details, magnetic fields observations are very difficult to get precisely. Mm. Simply because of the fact that in astronomy, the majority of the things that we measure are with light. We have gravitational waves as well, of course, but that's new, and that's also limited in the scope of what we can observe. Magnetic fields don't emit any light, and so we need to rely on how they affect the material within the clouds to then be able to actually get measurements. But the problem is that when you probe the smaller scales, you do it with longer wavelengths. And with longer wavelengths, the odds, essentially, of getting a detection are much lower. So you need much more time to be able to measure the polarization of the light and then get an understanding of the morphology. And especially on a system which is as competitive as ALMA and the ACA, what they've done is quite impressive.
Speaking of low odds, neutral atomic hydrogen has been found in a star-forming galaxy 7 billion years ago. Neutral atomic hydrogen, or H1, has long been used as one of our main tracers for the evolution of galaxies, and up until recently, we were only able to directly observe it within the local universe. A team have now been able to see this gas up to 7 billion years ago through gravitational lensing. H1 is our premier tracer for the evolution of galaxies, as it is effectively the raw fuel used for star formation. So anything that disrupts or changes the H1 content of a galaxy will then have a knock-on effect on its ability to keep making new stars. We also use this H1 to look into the environments of galaxies, because a galaxy's H1 disk actually extends much further out than the optical disk you would see when looking at it with your eyes. So by looking into this gas, we can start to determine whether galaxies evolve through nature, whether that's processes within themselves, or nurture, due to interactions with the environment that surrounds them. So H1 itself is abundant in galaxies, but its 21-centimeter emission is intrinsically faint. In the nearby universe, the signal is strong enough to detect directly, and just a tiny bit further out. But at large distances, it becomes extremely challenging to observe. Some techniques do exist, like stacking, where we combine many individual faint galaxies to get detection. However, this team led by scientists in South Africa, the UK and Germany have been able to see this faint gas at 7 billion years ago due to this gravitational lensing. Gravitational lensing is where you have a massive object in the foreground, like a galaxy cluster, that bends light from objects behind it. This light can then be detected, and is often a different shape, but more importantly for this work, is massively amplified. So, by looking at this H1 content that's been strongly lensed or amplified, this team were able to make a detection much further in the past. This is only possible because they were using Meerkat, not the animals, a radio interferometer in South Africa that is super sensitive. This is a breakthrough result in the field, and will allow astronomers to start investigating the evolution of galaxies halfway to cosmic noon, which was about 10 billion years ago, where we have very little understanding of galaxies' evolutions and their environments.
I'm always amazed by the sheer unlikeliness of some of the things that we observe in astronomy. Like, for example, this galaxy happens to be right at the exact right spot in comparison to us for the light to be amplified and lensed towards us.
Yep.
Is that something that happens often in cosmology?
So gravitational lensing is actually much more common than you might think. Think about how big the universe is. The likelihood that there's something behind something you already see is pretty high. But in this specific case, they had to go searching for a galaxy they knew was star-forming from their optical observations, and then they just had a little inkling to go, oh, why don't we look at the H1 and just check if that's also being amplified? So, as this is a very early result, we're not 100% confident on how common these kind of events would be. But, you know, like good ears, there's quite a few more out there.
That's very exciting. I love it when new doors open within the field. Next up, Sohini and Jamie chat with Seshadri Nadatur about his work on cosmology, primarily understanding cosmological tensions using DESI data in combination with existing probes.
Hello. So today we're joined by Sesh Nadatur, who is an associate professor at the Institute of Cosmology and Gravitation at the University of Portsmouth. His research focuses on using galaxy redshift surveys for cosmology. So whenever you're ready, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
To start with, would you like to briefly summarize what you are working on right now?
Right, so I work on two galaxy redshift survey collaborations. One of them is called the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, or DESI, and the other one is Euclid. Both of these are measuring the positions and redshifts of millions of galaxies. In DESI's case, around 60 plus million. Euclid will measure 30 or 35 million. And building 3D maps using this information, which we then analyze to find the statistical patterns in the way the galaxies cluster. And we use that to infer cosmological parameters.
Out of both DESI and Euclid and everything else that you have worked on, what is your personal favorite instrument, or I should say experiment, that to work on, just out of everything that you have touched, essentially?
DESI is particularly cool because it's I've worked on the predecessors of DESI a little bit as well, and it's really nice to see the massive improvement in the data quality and the speed with which the instrument operates. But although I have lots of complicated things to do with Euclid, but Euclid is a space telescope which is operating, you know, a million miles away from Earth, and it's providing these amazing images and data. And it's doing something which we haven't really done before. We haven't done a big galaxy redshift survey from space. So in that sense, it's amazing that we can do anything at all. And paying the price of extra complication in the data analysis is a small price to pay. It's very nice to work with DESI data because it's so much easier to do because it builds on 20 plus years of ground-based surveys that we've done before. And Euclid is a lot newer, so it's more challenging, but also very exciting.
Speaking of these challenges, what specifically is challenging about Euclid that comes from it being based in, you know, a million miles from Earth?
Well, firstly, if you launch a telescope into space, particularly if it's at Lagrange point 2, which is where Euclid is, if something goes wrong, that's it. You're never going to repair it. So there was a lot of quality control and so on that went into designing Euclid and building the instrument and then launching it, which means that it took a good 12, 13 years to get Euclid up into space. So that's a major challenge because, I mean, I've been working on Euclid for a few years, but some colleagues of mine have been working on it for nearly two decades now. And I think, you know, that's the major thing. But then also, the way Euclid is designed, at least for the spectroscopic side, has this challenge that it's doing slitless spectroscopy. So it's trying to measure the spectra of many galaxies all at once, which is a complicated thing that we haven't done for galaxy redshift survey before. So it's a new measurement, and that's proving to be more complicated than what we do beautifully with DESI, which is to put a single fiber on each galaxy that we want to measure and get the spectrum, a nice clean spectrum from it.
Potentially a stupid question coming from silly little intensity mapper, but how does slitless spectroscopy work?
So Euclid has a grism. In fact, it has two grisms which are at different angles, and they can also be slightly rotated. And so it splits up the light of all the sources in the field of view into spectra, and these spectra just form these lines on the CCD that you measure. And then by doing another pass with a slightly rotated grism, you get the lines slightly change angle. And by looking at the overlap of those, you can basically identify which source each spectral line belongs to. And then you have to go and look at the pixels and measure the intensity at each pixel along the line. And that gives you the flux at different wavelengths because it's been split by the grism and spread over this over the CCD. And then from that, you work out the spectrum and measure the redshift.
Cool. Thank you. So once you've taken the galaxy surveys with these instruments, what do you then go on to do with them? Like what do we, aside from learning about the galaxies themselves, can we learn anything more about the universe from these galaxy surveys?
Yes. So what I do in particular is looking at the patterns in the clustering of these galaxies, so quite large scales, at scales where each individual galaxy is of no interest to me as a cosmologist. It's obviously of a lot of interest to people who are studying the evolution of galaxies themselves and how they form, and dynamics within them and so on. But for me, I'm interested in the whole set of millions of these galaxies and the statistical patterns in their clustering across the sky, because they're not randomly distributed. Galaxies bunch together and cluster because of the action of gravity, and this is counteracted by the universe expanding with time. So you get structures forming in a particular way, and by measuring the statistical properties of the clustering, we can then determine how fast the universe has been expanding over the last several billion years, and also the action of gravity and how that has been affecting the growth rate of structures.
Out of both of these experiments that you're working on, DESI has been running for a long time, but because it has accumulated so much data, it's quite interesting. Euclid has recently started operations, so it's also giving out interesting results. So what is something that you are looking forward to from either of these experiments in the next, let's say, year or a couple of years?
As you said, DESI's already been operating for about nearly 5 years now. and we're expecting the first data release of Euclid later this year. What's really cool about Euclid is it is actually, on this space telescope, there are two different instruments that are completely complementary. So there's the one that I work on, which is getting a precise three-dimensional map of the positions of 30-odd million galaxies and measuring the galaxy clustering signal from that. But there's another instrument, which is operating in the visible part of the spectrum, and that's just taking photographs, very, very deep and precise photographs of galaxies so that you can measure their shapes. So you don't get information on the depth or precise information on how far away the galaxies are from you, but you measure their shapes and you can analyze the effect, the tiny effect on the shapes of the galaxies and their orientations that comes from a weak gravitational lensing due to matter between us and those galaxies. And these are two complementary probes, so galaxy clustering and weak lensing. And by having them both on the same instrument, you basically double the power of the instrument. And so you should get much tighter constraints on cosmology. And we're hoping that we do when we put the Euclid data out.
Interesting. I think all of us who are working in cosmology are looking forward to that, even though what we are working on is pretty different.
At the start of your talk, you talked about you could kind of split cosmology into like three pillars. Could you talk a little bit about each of those three pillars and how they relate to your work on DESI and Euclid?
Right. Dark energy is the easiest one to start with because it's something that is... We don't know what dark energy is, but we know that the expansion of the universe is accelerating currently and has been accelerating in the relatively recent past. And what we are interested in doing is measuring that rate of expansion very precisely as we can, over the last several billion years, so that we can really pin down any changes to the rate of acceleration, which might give us a clue as to what dark energy is. And that's primarily what I work on with galaxy redshift surveys. We measure distances. By measuring distances, we figure out how big the universe was at different epochs. And so we can figure out how it's been expanding and reconstruct that expansion history. So in my talk, when I was talking about dark energy, that's one of the things I meant. Both dark energy, meaning the way that the universe is expanding, and dark matter, which I used as a shorthand form for, you know, formation of structures, these things go hand in hand and they dictate the details of the perturbations in density that we see in these maps once we've reconstructed them. So that's another thing that we're trying to measure. So not just the background expansion rate, but the details of those perturbations as measured by the power spectrum of the galaxies. And those perturbations are also then measurable through weak lensing and other probes, which I don't directly work on, but are very complementary and very useful. And these together are what I would call large-scale structure studies, enabled by surveys like DESI and Euclid. And then you go back to the very early universe, and you can measure things from recombination and the last scattering surface using the CMBE. But then there's a period before that that sets the initial conditions that have then evolved under gravity and with the growth of the universe. And there's a lot of interest in figuring out what were those initial conditions, what happened before, you know, at the time of the Big Bang or before the Big Bang in some sense of the word, when you have inflation. And the cool thing is that actually there are signatures of that early physics that can be found both imprinted in the CMB, which is where they've traditionally been studied for quite a long time, because the CMB has been well measured since WMAP, but also in particular patterns in the distribution of galaxies. So we're hoping to measure signatures of primordial non-Gaussianity, potentially, or at least, you know, constrain, put upper limits on what it could be in the galaxy distribution. And that would be telling us directly about the physics at the very early universe a long time ago. So, you know, I think that's really cool how we can tie together periods that are very, very far apart by making measurements today from Earth or from L2.
That's really interesting. So in your talk, you talked about how the cosmological constraint, or I should say, constraints on cosmological quantities don't agree when they're measured from different sources or different measuring techniques, let's say. Do you see all of these? This question has two parts, actually. Do you see that a future where we are able to get them to agree to some degree of confidence? And do you have a preferred method or like one of these techniques that you are likely to believe more?
That's a good question. I can certainly imagine a future in which they end up agreeing better, because the level of disagreement that I was talking about between the CMB and BAO is not particularly large at the moment, right? So within Lambda CDM, we're talking about something that is a little bit less than 3 sigma, which is, 3 sigma type of fluctuations do happen, and they might not be necessarily telling us about some new physics. But I really hope they are telling us about some new physics, because that would be much more exciting. But we'll just have to wait and see. And it's very important for us to not kind of prejudge that answer. Our job is to actually go and make these measurements and see what the universe is telling us without putting the answers down that we want to hear. In terms of which method I prefer, I work on galaxy clustering and BAO. So obviously I like that. But I think actually both are very robust and very mature techniques, which is why a discrepancy between them, even though it's not particularly statistically significant, is kind of promising. Sometimes you have in cosmology discrepancies or tensions between two techniques where one of them you don't trust quite so much. But I do really trust both the CMB and BAO quite a lot. I don't think that there's much room for unknown systematic effects that we haven't yet accounted for in either of these two data sets. So that's why I'm cautiously optimistic.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. Speaking of tensions as well, like cosmological tensions, there are quite a few. Some have been resolved and some that remain unresolved. And this might be a politically sensitive question, but there's a lot of effort in the cosmological community or astrophysics community in general to come up with alternative models to Lambda CDM. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that approach, let's say, of resolving this tension?
So I think we need all types of approaches as a field, right? We should have theorists go and come up with all kinds of crazy ideas. And most of them will be wrong. In fact, almost all of them will be wrong, because only one crazy idea could possibly be the correct one. And maybe none of them will be correct. But that's fine. So we should have a two-pronged approach where some theorists go and, you know, come up with every idea that they could think of, but the people who are doing the data analysis are very, very careful at checking more mundane explanations as well, because it's unlikely to be any of these exotic new physical models that people like to dream up. And it is much more likely in general that a tension that you see between two different data sets is resolved by some one of those, or maybe both of those, measurement techniques being improved or refined in some way.
You talked a lot about DESI, and I really found the slide interesting where you showed how it operated, with all the little pieces turning. So could you tell our listeners a little bit more about how DESI works, what makes it different to other instruments?
The key thing about DESI is that it's designed to measure many, many galaxy redshifts. And in order to do that within a certain number of years of operation, you've got to be very fast at measuring these galaxy redshifts per year, per night. So one aspect of this is having a big telescope. And we use the Mayol 4-meter telescope, whereas the previous Sloan Digital Sky Survey telescope used a 2.5-meter one. So obviously, the bigger collecting area, you can get more light and measure things faster. But really, the most significant improvement is that we have these robotic fiber positioners. Each one holds a fiber optic cable. And the way that a survey like DESI works is you start with a what we call an imaging survey, which is a map of potential galaxy positions on the sky, from which you select a list of targets that you think are probably galaxies and worth measuring redshifts for. And then when you have this map, you know the coordinates on which you want to go and measure a redshift. And so through your night of observation, you've pre-programmed when you point at a particular part of the sky, each robotic positioner is going to choose one potential galaxy target to lock in on, and it moves to the correct position so that the light from that object goes through that particular cable and goes to a spectrograph where it can be split into an individual spectrum that comes from that one object. And then we can measure the redshift. Not all of the things that we look at in our target catalog are actually going to be galaxies. Some of them would mistakenly be, you know, stars that are identified as galaxies. And also, the target catalog has far more objects than we can realistically observe with fibers, so some galaxies get missed out. But by doing this in the most appropriate way, you build an unbiased catalog of galaxies that you have actually measured redshifts for.
Interesting. Speaking of measuring so many galaxies, you are measuring millions of sources by the end of the survey. How do you categorize these sources? What are stars? What are galaxies? What are quasars?
This is actually something that I got involved in a few years ago, and I learned a lot of physics by doing that. So when you measure a spectrum, what you have is a bank of template type of spectra that have been built up through observations of many previous objects. And so you know that a star, say a K star or an M star, has a particular type of a spectrum. A white dwarf star has a different type of a spectrum with certain features in it. And then a galaxy, which is made up of millions of billions of stars, hundreds of billions of stars, has a spectrum that is built up of a composite of the individual stars in it. So for different types of galaxies, where they are in their evolution history, you have different templates of what those spectra should look like. And given your measured spectrum, you try fitting different templates to this and see which type fits best, where you allow the redshift of the template spectrum to vary so that it could match potentially an object at a different redshift. And because we're measuring so many millions of these galaxies, obviously you don't do this by hand. You have an automated algorithm. And in the early days of DESI, we spent a lot of time where this algorithm, which in DESI is called RedRock, would produce some classifications. And then we had human volunteers go through and check them and provide a truth table of, you know, this is actually that kind of galaxy, or it's not a galaxy, it's a star. And this was used to retrain the algorithm so that it could perform better. And by doing this as a, you know, a relatively junior person a few years ago, I learned a lot of physics about the different kinds of galaxies and what sort of spectral features they might have.
That's really interesting. So now that the algorithm is a little bit more mature, how long does it take you to perform this fitting for, let's say, I don't know, a million galaxies or a million sources?
Well, we don't typically perform it for a million sources at a time. What happens is the telescope operates at night, mm-hmm. and at the every day you take those nightly observations and they get processed mm-hmm. during the daytime. I mean, there might be some backlogs sometimes, but generally that's what it's. You have a nightly reduction every night, and then sometimes some objects get flagged as being needing to be reprocessed, and you go through and do a better reprocessing. And occasionally the algorithm gets updated, or some changes are made in the pipeline, and you reprocess things to get a final catalog. But yeah, it's chunked up so that you're not doing everything all at once at the end, but you're keeping on top of these observations as they come in every night.
That's really interesting. What are you most excited for, just in generally across all of astro and cosmology? Is there anything that we haven't talked about previously you're really excited to either see, maybe like an instrument or results from an instrument?
I'm very excited to see the final results from DESI. And that's partly because I've been working on DESI for so long, and I've seen how wonderful the results that we have got so far are already. I know that we will have even better results soon. So that's very exciting. I'm also excited about Euclid, but in a different way, because we're much earlier in the lifetime of Euclid, and there's a lot more work to be done. We haven't already seen cosmology results from Euclid yet. So that's a little bit more futuristic. But I'm also thinking now about future survey experiments that we will have, and those will also have very exciting results. So one of the things that I'm very excited about is the follow-up survey to DESI, which is called DESI 2, which will probe new types of targets at higher redshifts and higher densities. That would be great. I also wrote a proposal for a new space mission that's led by colleagues in the US and is being proposed to NASA, which would measure not 60 million, but 130 million or more galaxies for operating from a space-based telescope, which might revolutionize the field. So, you know, these kinds of futuristic things are great, but we also have lots of nice opportunities with the data that we're already collecting.
To end the interview, I have a non-astronomy related question, but still sort of something that all of us kind of go through. So in astronomy, we have to migrate a lot often, and you have been to like three different countries throughout your academic career and your professional career. What are some words of wisdom or like some lesson that you have learned throughout this process that you would like to share with somebody who's also going through this process?
Right. I think I was quite lucky in many ways, because given family situations and so on, it was possible for me to move. And my partner, who's now my wife, was able to come and join me as we set off on this tour of different countries, which probably isn't the case for a lot of people. But if it is possible, I would suggest viewing, you know, the inevitable moving countries and or moving cities even within a country as a bit of an adventure. At that time of my life, you know, I moved to Germany and I threw myself into learning German for a couple of years. And then I moved from Germany to Finland, which was a completely different, amazing experience, you know, with the endless summer sunshine and the eternal darkness in winter and lots of snow, and it was minus 30 degrees in the winter and so on. So, you know, there's lots of very cool experiences. And now that I'm a bit older, I wouldn't be quite so enthusiastic about uprooting my life and moving somewhere. But I think at the stage of when you finish your PhD and you're going into your first postdoc job, you might have the freedom to view these things with a sense of adventure. And I think you should, if possible, take that sense of adventure in and enjoy the life experience.
Great. I'll take that under advisement. Thanks again for coming and talking to us, Ash.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, Barbara talks to Maggie Liu, aka Spacemog on YouTube, from the University of Nottingham, about her path into astronomy and how she uses galaxy clusters to understand cosmology, the structure of the universe, and how machine learning can help astronomers in the age of big data.
Hello, I'm here with Maggie Liu. It's so nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Maggie Liu is a research fellow of machine learning and cosmology at the University of Nottingham. Previously, she was also a research fellow at the European Space Agency. She was based in Madrid and working with Euclid, which is European Space Agency mission to study properties of dark energy and dark matter at large scales. So can you tell us a bit more about kind of your journey into astronomy and what drew you to it?
I think like everyone in astronomy, I've always loved space and looking at the night sky. And I guess like the listeners listening probably don't know, but Barbara's from Chile. And I remember going observing for the first time during my PhD and seeing actual like Milky Way and endless stars and galaxies. And it was just like so amazing. But that's what I like dreamt of as a kid when I went camping with my dad and like seeing so many stars away from light pollution and thinking how vast the universe is and how I wanted to explore it. That's what really drew me to astronomy and space. But I didn't really know that I was going to study it at the time. It was just something that I liked and I thought was really cool. So my undergraduate degree was in astronomy, space science and astrophysics because I just wanted to go to space. And then I did a year at UCLA in Los Angeles, and that's at that point, I realized that I did want to do a PhD, because that was when I was introduced to cosmology and realized that if you could do cosmology, you can understand everything about the universe, all of its past, all of its future, like, is just confined to a few numbers. And I thought that was like the coolest thing to work on. And it seems like, wow, if you can constrain these handful of numbers, you know everything. Surely that is the purpose of life.
Yeah.
So that's why I did a PhD on weak gravitational lensing around galaxy clusters, specifically to measure their masses so that we can constrain cosmology.
Very cool. Yeah, no, I think a lot of us doing like our PhDs and that can really relate to that feeling of like having this fascination with space. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners can as well. And I'm glad to hear that you've been to Chile.
It wasn't until later in my PhD that I got to go to Chile and take some real science data that we were using. We were at Cerro Tololo.
Oh, yeah. And I've been close to it. I've never been to it, but I've seen it like with my eyes.
Apparently you can see LSST from that.
You can now, yes.
Yeah, so yes. I'd love to go back because at the time it was not a thing.
Yeah, no, it's really nice. But I was there recently with my family and we went camping in like...
In the mountains.
Yeah, in Valle del Elqui.
That's
and
so
we
cool.
saw, we were able to see Cerro Tololo, LSST, and you could see all of them in the night sky. It was great. It's like outdoor camping. Yeah, it was really cool. So if you're ever back, or if anyone listening is interested in going to Chile, definitely go to La Serena.
I didn't realize you could go camping there.
Yeah, you do astronomy and cosmology, but you obviously are into machine learning as well. And a lot of your research is machine learning and AI. So can you kind of explain a little bit how your research led you to using these tools?
Yeah, so machine learning for me is just a tool. I got into it during my PhD. I was doing a lot of Bayesian statistics mm-hmm. for my inference of cluster masses. And then actually when I moved to the European Space Agency to do my research fellowship there, that's when I realized I wanted to move towards kind of the machine learning route. And that was actually a big no-no for Bayesian statistics because they were like, right. Oh, no, you don't want to do machine learning. You won't capture your uncertainties and all that lot. So I don't know. I wanted to go into that route because I thought it was cool and I thought it was kind of the route forward for the mass amounts of data that we were receiving in astronomy. Because Bayesian statistics is great, but it is quite computationally expensive and it's not going to scale to the massive like dimensionalities that we have and the massive amounts of data that we have. Yeah, we really need to go down this machine learning route. So I wanted to do that. And then some of my colleagues at ESA came up with a project to search for asteroids in Euclid data. So Euclid is a space telescope run by the European Space Agency specifically for gravitational lensing measurements to map out the dark universe, dark matter and dark energy through gravitational lensing. But one of the contaminants are asteroids because they're slowly moving on the sky with a little bit of an exposure. Then you get these kind of elliptical shapes, which seem like elliptical galaxies. And if you include that in your gravitational lensing measurements, then you would get massively wrong cluster masses, for example. So using machine learning to filter through massive amounts of Euclid data in order to get rid of these contaminants. And from there, I've applied machine learning to black holes, to Lyman Alpha galaxies, to everything really, even things that aren't astronomy based, things like nematodes, like worms.
Oh.
we did a study looking at nematodes in simulated microgravity. Simulated through a superconducting magnet. Mm-hmm. So the effects of the electromagnet repels the effect of gravity, so you can get zero G conditions. The smallest thing that we can fit in there are little worms, and we just study them, their movement and behavior in microgravity.
That's so interesting. So are these like, how small are these worms?
When they're born, they are not visible to the naked eye. But at adult stage, they're about 2 millimeters in size. So they're very, very small.
That's really cool. Yeah. And that's more related to like space research instead of like cosmology, which is what you mostly do, right?
Absolutely.
That's so
and
cool.
A lot of people study it for kind of the effects of healthcare because these nematodes have like 90% human-like, similar genes to humans.
Right. Such interesting work. And you're doing that with machine learning.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So just to backtrack a bit, you mentioned earlier that, you know, statisticians and Bayesian statisticians specifically were kind of against you going the route of machine learning. So can you explain a bit more about kind of why that is and where that tension comes from between statistics and machine learning?
So in Bayesian statistics, everything revolves around priors. So you input prior information, and that helps you constrain like the outputs that you're trying to constrain. Everything is kind of theoretically backed. So you're doing something with a purpose. With machine learning, it's not like that. It's about pushing in as many parameters as possible so that you can map the most complex of functions, the high dimensionality. It's about getting the best hardware, getting the biggest models, and you should be able to reproduce anything with it. So for that reason, I think like a lot of the Bayesian community don't really like machine learning.
Yeah. But that's changing, isn't it? Like, I know Bayesian machine learning is a thing, and there's more crossover with, you know, machine learning becoming kind of a new big tool in kind of our tool shed as astronomers, and not just astronomers, right, in all sciences. Can you explain kind of what physics-informed neural networks are?
Physics-informed neural networks just implements the physics into your loss function. So the loss function is kind of the thing that you want to minimize. And typically in machine learning, this will be like if you've got a label, the ground truth that you know, and your model outputs some value, you want to kind of minimize the distance between those two. With physics-informed networks, you can fold in physics that you expect, the properties that it would have and laws that it should satisfy.
Yeah, so all very, very interesting stuff. So go back to the astronomy for a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about your research right now and, you know, the research that you're applying machine learning to? What is it? How is it related to cosmology, and how is it related to galaxies and clusters?
Yeah, absolutely. So the ultimate goal is cosmology. My field of research is clusters of galaxies, and these are the largest gravitationally bound objects in our universe, and they live in like the nodes of the large scale structure in our universe, so like the densest regions. And you can see from simulations that the structure of our universe looks very different depending on the cosmology that you put in. So these are things like how fast the universe is expanding, how big were the fluctuations in the early universe, how much dark matter and dark energy there is in the universe. So galaxy clusters make an excellent probe for the growth of structure. And particularly what we have is called the cluster mass function, which is basically the number of galaxy clusters at a given redshift and a given mass. But the kind of normalization and slope and shape of this function is very dependent on cosmology. So basically, all you have to do to use galaxy clusters for to constrain cosmology is count how many galaxy clusters there are and measure their masses and redshifts accurately. Now, cluster masses are notoriously difficult to measure. So a lot of my PhD work was using X-rays and weak lensing to measure their weak lensing mass and X-ray mass. Gravitational lensing is when the light from distant galaxies travels within the vicinity of a massive halo, a gravitational potential well, it will get distorted, gets perturbed by this gravitational potential well, and it appears distorted to us. So by measuring like the distortions in the shapes of galaxies, you can figure out how much mass there is in that region. And that's what I did in my PhD, but also worked on X-ray masses. These are measured from the X-ray surface brightness of galaxy clusters and also their temperature gradients that we get from the spectra. But both of these have various different biases involved. In weak lensing, we have a lot of triaxiality, we get projection effects. So sometimes if we're looking at galaxy clusters along like a filament, we might kind of mistake that as a galaxy cluster, but they are just chance alignments of galaxies. Hydrostatic masses from X-rays, that assumes hydrostatic equilibrium. So it assumes that the kind of hot intracluster gas is kind of repelled perfectly by the gravity, preventing it from collapsing. And it assumes that it's a perfectly spherical galaxy cluster.
So this is at the galaxy cluster level, because I think, and maybe a lot of people are probably familiar with hydrostatic equilibrium in things like stars, but mm-hmm. you're talking about like...
on galaxy cluster scales.
Massive scale. That's so interesting, yeah.
But galaxy clusters aren't spherical and nice and well-behaved because right. we have AGN and we have a lot of feedback effects that kind of disrupt this gas. And so these mass measurements aren't perfect. So it's kind of like developing strategies to better estimate these cluster masses. And then also some work on detection of galaxy clusters, because these are also important. If you're measuring a mass of something, you want to make sure it is a galaxy cluster yes. and not a supermassive black hole.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. The stuff that you did during your PhD when you were not using machine learning, or maybe, you know, the methods that are used today that are the standard method, can you talk a little bit about those methods and kind of what they're good at and why they maybe are not so good in this era of computationally expensive and big data astronomy?
Okay. So like traditionally, what astronomers would do would be they would look at up into the night sky, and then they would pick out these galaxy clusters. And they would have a selection effect, because you can't pick out every single galaxy cluster. You'd probably pick it out to some limiting X-ray flux, for mm-hmm. example, and then measure each individual cluster mass. And then usually you would have to stack them together with weak lensing, because the signal is very, very weak. In weak gravitational lensing, effects of gravitational lensing changes like the shapes of the galaxies by of order 1 or 2%. So it's tiny. So usually you have to stack many galaxy clusters that you think are similar because they're at the same redshift, similar temperatures. We can stack those together and hope to get the same mass. And then after that, you would bin them up into the Halley mass function and then fit for a cosmology. Now, that's not a good way to do it. So before, I was working on a lot of Bayesian methods, specifically hierarchical modeling. And in those cases, you start from the top and go down to the bottom. In those cases, you say, okay, what if the cosmology is this? How many galaxy clusters of a particular mass would I expect? And what would those weak lensing signals look like? If you do it like this way, it becomes exponentially more computationally expensive, because you have to kind of compute what the universe would look like for every single cosmology that you would sample for.
But I can also, you know, see that with all these, you know, like multi-dimensional, like multi-parameter problem, this starts looking like a problem for machine learning, right? So how does that come in, and how does that help this very computationally expensive problem?
Back when I was doing my PhD, the sample of clusters I was working on were 100 galaxy clusters. Now we have telescopes like Euclid and LSST, and we expect like hundreds of thousands of galaxy clusters.
With that scale of data and all the things that come with it, how are you using machine learning then to work through this? Like what methods are you using, and how has that helped accelerate, maybe improve your research?
One thing that machine learning is great at doing is accelerating our computations. We can do things quite quickly. We can build what we call emulators. If we can show enough examples to a machine learning algorithm of what we expect the output to look like for some given input parameters, the machine learning algorithm should be able to learn the pattern to map the two very quickly, rather than going through all the complex math and theory that we typically have to go through. I've been working on kind of speeding these computations up. Similar things in the field of astronomy people are doing are kind of bypassing entire simulations altogether. Rather than simulating the universe at every single cosmology, you could actually simulate for a number of cosmologies and then use kind of machine learning to interpolate between those to see what the universe looks like. So simulations that could take like several months or a year to run would take like minutes to run with machine learning once yeah. trained.
Yeah, that's all super impressive. Machine learning is is a really, really cool tool, in my opinion. Well, my PhD is also related to machine learning, so of course I think that.
You know this already.
Of course I would say that. Do you think that the best thing about machine learning is the, you know, the speed up in the computations, or do you think is more how good it is at picking out these subtle patterns? Like, where do you think the power of it truly is?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think we still need to be very careful with machine learning because it is only as good as the training data we give it. So it's never going to be able to kind of come up with things that are like not in the training data. It might be able to flag outliers that don't look like your data, but it's never going to be able to kind of generate things that it hasn't really seen or is within the domain that it's trained within. So we have to be very careful with that. Also, a lot of astronomy is done by hand. I mean, we've gone a long way, like in the last maybe couple of decades. I think maybe 30 years ago, they were still identifying stars and galaxies by hand on massive photographic plates. Mm-hmm. And now we have algorithms that kind of filter through images to search for them with specific filters. But now this is kind of a step up. We've got filters that adapt with machine learning to find patterns that we as humans wouldn't be able to see ourselves. Yeah. For us, it's hard to think of anything outside of 3D because we live in a 3D world. Machine learning, it doesn't care about like the dimensionality. So it can find patterns that are not obvious to us at all.
But let's talk a little bit about the drawbacks. You brought up a really cool example yesterday at your talk about overfitting to something very specific and unintended in a set of images of horses. So can we talk a little bit about overfitting?
So this comes back to the training data, essentially. Machine learning is great at mapping patterns in your training data. So from your inputs to your labels, you can find how to map that perfectly. If you train your neural network long enough and it has enough parameters, you should be able to reproduce kind of every single, if it's for images, for example, you should be able to reproduce every single image. That is what we call overfitting, that we allow the network to learn the pattern to exactly reproduce the results that we want.
It's like memorizing versus learning, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So it would never generalize. So the example that I showed was the classification of horses. And this was a case in the Pascal VOC competition. So this was like early day ImageNet competition, the benchmark for machine learning algorithms in computer vision. And consistently, all the entries would classify some of the images as horses and others not as horses, but they were clearly all horses. So what was going wrong was that in the training data, all the horse images were taken by the same photographer. So they all had a stamp from that particular photographer on, and the machine learning algorithm just trained and trained so well that it just picked out those kind of stamps in every single case. And that just shows you, machine learning is powerful. It can find the patterns, but you need to make sure that those patterns that it's finding is really the patterns that you're looking for rather than kind of artifacts or other things that are included in your training data.
How does this relate to astronomy? So for instance, if you were to train a model on data from just one instrument, would that model work on data from another instrument? Obviously, it wouldn't have a mark, like a copyright mark, like the images you showed. But are there instrumental things that I could pick up
on? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That's a big thing. So instrument to instrument, no, you would not expect it to work well. Even like the pixel scales would be different, but you'd have instrumental effects. You don't want to be overtraining on like the instrumental effects of one particular instrument and then not finding it in another. It would work if your model was trained on many different instruments and you could pick out a new instrument and it might work on that. But if your training data just comes from a single instrument, you should not expect it to work on a different instrument. And that is a major concern that I have with astronomy at the moment, because in like machine learning, everyone just works with simulations. And I don't think that any would actually work on real data, given that they're all trained on simulations.
I've heard this argument of should we use simulations or not, and I know that there are people who are like completely against it and that they think that any simulations, you know, machine learning model wouldn't necessarily be able to pick up on something similar in real data. So, but it's nice to hear that there's kind of, at least you seem to think that there's like a middle ground.
Yeah.
So it's not like simulations are absolutely useless and have no place.
They are helpful because there you can get a wide variety of data. And that's what machine learning does well on, is if you feed it huge amounts of data to train on.
All right. So just to pivot, you said something earlier about being interested in like fashion and your teachers thinking that you would be like a spacesuit designer. So can you talk a little bit about that?
At the end of year 11, like start of sixth form, I read an article about MIT professor called Dava Newman, and she'd created the first bio suit, which was a spacesuit for astronauts that is not like your typical spacesuits. It hugged your body. It had like thermal regulation and everything inside. And I just thought she was like the coolest person ever. Like, how could scientists be so cool? I think like growing up, I didn't really see like scientists as women. You mainly think of old white men who are scientists. So when you see like women achieve so much, become like a professor at MIT, design spacesuits that look very sci-fi. I loved watching sci-fi movies as a kid. I think that inspired me a lot.
Right. So I also have a secondary mic on me, because we're recording this for YouTube as well.
Yes.
You have a YouTube channel. You are interested in outreach. So what is that like for you? What do you get out of that? And why have you started, you know, talking to the masses?
I think you know as well, because you do loads of it yourself. it is very, very rewarding. And I think it's important because, like I said, growing up, I didn't see many women in science fields. I didn't see it as an option for something I would go into. And actually, like, even my parents, they don't really know anything about space. And I was the first in my family to go to university. So it wasn't like I really had much to go off of.
Right.
And now I think it's so great that there's so many opportunities for kids to see what real astronomers look like. And that they're like normal people. They're not like necessarily super intelligent, out of reach people. They're just normal people who just like space and like astronomy. Getting that visibility out is super important to me. It's super rewarding when people say that they're inspired. I feel touched that people actually like the stuff that I produce. It's super important because a lot of people as well who go into astronomy and physics, it's super applicable to a lot of things in life. People go into finance, people go into data science, machine learning. Like, there's so many fields that you can kind of pivot to from astronomy and astrophysics.
But no, I think it's all very valuable. And I think outreach is really important to reach all the people who maybe think that they are not good enough. And, well, that's not true. So thank you so much for being on the Jodcast and giving such a wonderful interview.
Yeah, thank you everyone for listening.
Lastly, Josh and Louis take the Jodcast on the road. Well, down the road, really. To the Euclid UK and LSST UK meeting 2026. They ask conference attendees about their experiences in astronomy, their favorite results, and the number one thing they are looking forward to in the future of LSST and Euclid.
Hi everyone, I'm Josh.
And I'm Louis, and we're reporting live from the LSST and Euclid meeting in Manchester.
Euclid is a 1.2 meter space telescope launched on the 1st of July 2023, equipped to record visible light and the near infrared using a spectrometer. It reached a halo orbit around the Sun and the Earth at the second Lagrange point, averaging a distance of 1.5 million kilometres between the Earth and the Sun. The European Space Agency's Euclid mission is designed to explore the composition and evolution of the dark universe. The space telescope is going to create a great map of the large-scale structure of the universe across space and time by observing billions of galaxies out to 10 billion light years, across more than a third of the night sky. Euclid will explore how the universe has expanded and how structure has formed over cosmic history, revealing more about the role of gravity and the nature of dark energy and dark matter.
Well, LSST stands for the Legacy Survey of Space and Time, and is taking place at the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile. It will take detailed images of the southern hemisphere sky every 3 days for 10 years, creating an almost stop-motion movie of the night sky. This will allow researchers to investigate asteroids and comets, pulsating stars, supernova explosions, and much more.
We were lucky enough to come along to the joint day of the Euclid and LSST UK meeting, and we had the chance to interview some of the participants about their work with both telescopes. Over to our roaming reporters.
Perfect. So, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Bob Nicol, alumni of the University of Manchester, wow. 85 to 88.
Very exciting.
So, yes, I'm very proud of my heritage.
Very happy to have you back on the podcast.
Well, this is actually my first time. So, I've been waiting 40 years.
So, we're here at the Euclid and LSST conference. What do you do in these projects? What sort of is your area of research?
So, I'm quite proud. I'm what's called a founder of Euclid.
Wow.
So, quite a rare membership level. We get membership levels in these big collaborations. So, but that really means I was part of the group that first proposed Euclid, went through the many layers of ESA qualification, through selection to eventually launch. So actually, I think I've been involved in Euclid since 2004, I want to say. So yeah, it's been a 20-year journey, but we launched it in 23, as you know, and it's been phenomenal. Just been an amazing instrument and telescope, given that it's only a small one compared to something like LSST, right? It's a relatively small satellite and a relatively small instrument, but in terms of its capability, it's unique. So that's what's quite fantastic about it.
So what's it like to be developing something for almost 20 years and then see it launch and have it in space, telescope like this?
So I have grown-up kids, and I took my kid to the launch, right? And there are not many things you can imagine. He was 21 at the time. Wow. There are not many things when your 21 turns to you, when your old turns to you and goes, "Wow, Dad," you know, that's pretty special, right?
That's really cool.
So yeah, we went out to Florida and watched it being launched on the SpaceX rocket, and then seeing the data coming in, right? The fact that when they turn it on and you get that first image, and of course with all these instruments you go through these strange, unexpected events. So, you know, when you look, you think now space engineering is so easy, but guess what? There were things we did not predict. So when we first turned on the instrument, there were unexpected things. We'd not predicted them, we'd not expected them, but, you know, just like with the Hail Mary, you know, you just have to go, "Oh my God, how do you solve that?" And that's when it gets scary, but, you know, it's also exciting because you get these really intense periods where you go, "Oh my God, I have to try and solve this problem, unless this satellite ain't going to work." So we had ice, right? I don't know if, yeah, so
wow.
You can't get rid of all the water. Mm-hmm. So when you put this thing into space, water is in the instruments and in the satellite so that it ices up. So ice forms on the optical mirror, on the dichroics, and it stops the throughput of the telescope.
And how did you solve that?
Well, guess what? You point it at the sun.
There we go.
It melts the ice.
Beautiful.
The funny story is they did that and they made it worse.
Oh, no.
So there was this moment in time where they thought, "Oh, my God, if we pointed at the sun again..." You don't really point it at the sun, by the way. You sort of just get the angle right so there's, you know, light can sort of bounce in. But, you know, the second time was like, "Well, if this doesn't work, we're out of options." But the second time we did it, it was fine.
From a scientific point of view, what are you most excited about with the results and where Euclid might take us?
So for me, I was always probably a bit controversial in I felt one could only do weak lensing, weak gravitational lensing from a space-based observatory. I know I might be going against a lot of my colleagues who are trying to do it from the ground, but it really felt that unique opportunity to get above the Earth's atmosphere to be able to have a large wide-angle survey of the extragalactic sky at the Hubble resolution across the whole sky. So that to me was that was always going to be that unique opportunity with Euclid. So that's what I'm looking forward to. But the strong lenses along the way have blown my mind. Just the number of those, tens of thousands of these strong lenses that you see, these wonderful Einstein rings. That I guess we knew that, but as with all these things, you run simulations and you look at a number on a screen and you go, "Oh yeah, there might be 10,000 of these things." But then you see them, right?
You see them.
Oh my God. and you see them again, and then you see more, and you see more, and you see more. Just incredible.
That's so cool. Perfect. That's everything. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Kathy Romer. I'm from the University of Sussex, but I'm absolutely delighted to be here today because I did my undergraduate degree in this building. And I'm sitting in the same seat in the lectures as I did when I 37 years ago.
Wow, that's amazing. What kind of stuff do you work on? Is it Euclid or LSST or both? What sort of field is your area of research?
I work in something called clusters of galaxies. And yeah, we use data from Euclid at the moment. There aren't any data from LSST yet, but we're working with the commissioning team to try and get the telescope ready for the main survey, which will take about 10 years. And then after about 10 years, we should be able to answer some questions about cosmology and the cosmological model.
What are you most excited about that's coming from these experiments?
Can I be honest and say I'm not that excited?
Yes, that's an interesting answer. Why?
Well, for the last nearly 20 years, we were working on something called the Dark Energy Survey, which is a precursor to the LSST, which is a survey that's done on the Rubin telescope. And so that broke a lot of barriers. We've done an awful lot of science. And so at some level, it's a bit like supersize me. It's really expensive. And I mean, it's fantastic data. It's absolutely fantastic data. But personally, I'm a bit old. I'm not that excited.
Is it just sort of diminishing returns, do you think?
Ooh, now that's a toughie. Now, the thing that LSST does that Dark Energy Survey never did, and Euclid won't do either, is the idea of going back to the same piece of the sky multiple times. So it's almost like you're making a movie. And that is going to be quite spectacular. Of course, things don't change very much outside of, let's say, our own galaxy or nearby galaxies. You don't really see many changes. The universe is very old and it's kind of, you know, just does its own thing. But of course, when you have supernovae, you can see those to very large distances. So those can sort of go bang between one observation and the next. Certainly the ability to look at gravitational lensing of supernovae is a new angle in cosmology that hasn't been tested really before. So yeah, there's lots of beautiful stuff that's going to come out of it.
So you said it's kind of like making a movie because you're scanning the same patch of sky again and again. Mm-hmm. Is there any work on using that to look at things close to us, not necessarily... cosmic and distance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of the reason that the Rubin telescope got funded is because the US government were duped into thinking that it would stop Earth-killing asteroids impacting the Earth.
Wow.
So somebody was clever enough to come up with a use case that persuaded people to open up their bank accounts. And yeah, it has. And already, even in the very early data, it's absolutely trivial for the Rubin telescope to find outer solar system objects. We did a lot of that work in the Dark Energy Survey as well, but Rubin's just... it's just extraordinary. There's just the number of objects that will be discovered and as being discovered, including objects that are coming from outside our solar system, which have a lot of interest in the media.
So it's sort of a case of the maybe extra solar system stuff, asteroids and stuff like that, that brings a lot of attention to the project and that allows you to get the funding to do the cosmology science that maybe isn't well,
true. The cosmology
public.
Also brings in funding, and that's partly because what was discovered in the end of the last century, that the universe's expansion accelerating, challenges some very fundamental aspects of physics. And that meant that a lot of funding that previously went into things like particle physics accelerators then came into the astronomy zone. So astronomers have benefited hugely from this mystery of dark energy. I sort of think of myself both as an astronomer and a cosmologist. So I feel as though I've benefited. But yeah, I'm getting a bit old now. So it's the young people who are going to get the most out of it. And Euclid is amazing too because it's in space. The pictures are just amazing.
Do you have a favourite picture that's been released by
Euclid? Well, there's one of a strong lens, like an Einstein ring, which is a very... I mean, it's a bright but rather boring looking galaxy. It doesn't have spiral arms. It's what we call an elliptical galaxy. So it just looks like a bright splodge. But it has so much dark matter that there's a galaxy behind it that has been gravitationally lensed. And you can see this ring around it, a bit like if you dropped a stone into a pond, you can see a ring around it. And the thing is, it's so beautiful. But it's so obvious in the Euclid data. Although it had already been discovered by the strong lensing team in Euclid, the official ones, one of my undergraduate students found it by accident, and he thought it was an aberration. And he showed it during one we were having a coffee meeting over Zoom, and I went, "No, it's an Einstein ring!" And yeah, that ended up in Nature. So
That was just so cool.
But it's because of the superb image quality. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I've got to go because I'm chairing a session about cosmology with Euclid. And,
thank you so much,
LSST.
And I'm here with
Phil Wiseman.
So, Phil, where have you come from to Manchester today?
So I work at the University of Southampton. So it was a direct 4-hour train.
So let's start with kind of what's your general area of research?
So I work with astrophysical transients. So these are time-varying sources and typically things that appear and disappear. We don't see them again. So these can come from anything like exploding stars, supermassive black holes swallowing things, accretion disks flaring, and even more exotic sources that we haven't really thought of yet.
So is there a specific type of those transients that you like to look at?
So I have sort of two hats. Mm-hmm. I have the more mundane things, which are the explosions of white dwarfs,
yep.
Which we call type 1A supernovae. And they are standardizable candles. Mm-hmm. So we can use them as distance indicators to infer the history of as cosmological expansion. We can measure distances in the universe with them. And I'm particularly interested in the actual galaxies that they explode in. So how does the type of galaxy, stars in that galaxy, the gas in that galaxy, and the dust in that galaxy affect the brightness, the color, the duration of the supernova, and actually how does that affect how we use those as tools in cosmology?
Very cool. Right.
Then my other hat is the more exotic half of what I do, which is with a relatively new, quite poorly understood class of transients. So poorly understood that they're called ambiguous nuclear transients. Okay. Right. So ambiguous means don't know what they are.
Yep.
Nuclear means not that they are nuclear reactions, means that they are from galactic nuclei. So they're from the center of galaxies. And transients means that they go up and down. And that's important because we are very, very used to flickering light from galactic nuclei. We call them active galactic nuclei. And we know of millions of these, and we've characterized them very well. Ambiguous nuclear transients, or ANTs, seem to be something a little bit different. So they are one time, they don't keep flickering up and down. And they seem to be kind of semi-related to the disruption of a star around the black hole and the subsequent accretion of the material. But they seem too bright, too long-lived compared to a normal star being eaten by a normal supermassive black hole. So the quest is on to try and find out what they are.
Brilliant. So as we are at the Euclid LST meeting, how does that quest tie into either of these projects?
I'm principally involved in LSST. It is, I'm sure this word has been used far too much throughout the week. It's going to be a complete revolution in the transient universe because it can find transients further away and over a broader area of sky combined than other surveys have done in the past. So for the Type 1A supernovae, we are going to be recording 100 times greater sample sizes than we've ever done before. And that can just completely opens up the things you can do statistically, but also in terms of understanding the systematic uncertainties, those little subtle effects that are affecting what you're looking at. For the ANT, it is the current sample size is somewhere around 15 to 20 objects,
okay.
Right? And with LSST, we're expecting somewhere, in the hundreds. So we're going to go from a small heterogeneous sample of collected objects from the last sort of 15 years that have been very ad hoc in how we found them to a systematically selected sample of things crossing all the way from these stellar tidal disruptions to active galactic nucleus flares and everything in between, and the ability then to completely characterize what those populations are.
Brilliant. I mean, it's super exciting stuff, especially in this kind of,
feels in the modern age, we are really pushing boundaries again. Perhaps you might have already answered this in the last bit, but if you were to give a result that you yourself are most excited for from this project, like, what is it that if you see it on archive in the morning, you are going to jump up and down?
Yeah, this for me will be the rare things becoming common.
Yes.
So objects that currently we only know of a handful, when there will be papers with samples of those that you can do statistics with. And that is exciting. Making rare things almost boring.
It's got to happen at some point.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time and very for well. Joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've put our question for our listeners on social media. How do you think the rapid rise of new technologies such as AI will affect the field of astronomy? We'd love to hear from you, so don't hesitate to let us know your thoughts, either via email or through our socials.
And now for my favourite part, the listener feedback. TK Arispa shared on Facebook, really enjoying the episode so far, as always. Keep up the great work. Thanks a lot, TK, for the consistent engagement and support. We really appreciate it. If you want to get in touch, you can do so via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, or send us a letter. Link and details can be found on our website at www.jodcast.net. We are also on LinkedIn, and we hope to connect with astronomers and listeners alike on the platform. Let us know if you're following us there. Thank you to Cesardi, Nedator, Maggie Liu, and the Euclid LSST attendees and organizers for the interviews. The audio editors were Jesse Marin, Louisa Mason, Josh Bishop, and Jamie Inslee. The show editor was Louisa Mason. The producer was Phoebe Ryder. Until next time,
Jot on!